Welcome to Legend Makers, the podcast where education's true heroes take center stage. And we are back with the Legend Makers podcast, and today I'm with Brittany Tarr. Oh, hey, Brittany, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I was just talking to you before we pressed record, and I'm really excited to speak with you today because, first off, kudos on the, for those of you watching, Brittany's got a great setup. Her lighting's on point. She got a mic. She sounds great. But here's the thing. I'm reading your bio that you gave me, okay? And I was watching you on Instagram and I was checking this out. And I'll be honest, I was, the laboratory school concept is new to me and I'm really looking forward to getting into this. So you are a pre-K through fourth grade STEM specialist at the Thomas Metcalf School, a laboratory school at Illinois State University. So I want to talk about that, but I'm going to go on and read the rest. So you're a teacher for 13 years. And prior to teaching STEM, you were a special ed teacher and an ELL teacher. You're also a doctoral student at the School of Teaching and Learning at Illinois State University. And you're, this is really interesting. Again, your research areas include STEM identity, well, early childhood STEM education, diversifying STEM, and play-based learning. I think I'm going to have a blast talking to you today. So that's your bio. Tell us about you. And then I want to learn about this laboratory school stuff that you're involved with. This is really neat. I looked it up a little. I was doing some research before we jumped on and it sounds great.
Yeah. So start with me or start with the laboratory?
Start with you, please. Yeah. You.
Sure. I feel like you said everything, but I definitely have a very diverse background. Most people, I don't really know how a lot of people come into the STEM position to teach STEM in elementary school, but I definitely came in it from kind of a backwards door. So okay. When I first got into education, which was later in life, I had a career before I did education. I was an ELL teacher. So I taught overseas in South Korea for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I taught kindergarten. So the way that it works when you're teaching overseas is that you teach, kindergarten, just like you would a kindergarten classroom here, but you're teaching it in English to a bunch of Korean children who don't speak English.
Yeah.
So I was a kindergarten teacher, but it just, my entire class was made up of non-native English speakers.
Wow.
And so that was a really cool experience. And then when I moved back to the States, I was a special ed teacher for many, many years. And so that is where I learned to teach STEM. I never was a STEM person growing up. I did really bad in STEM classes growing up, which I think is part of why I'm so passionate about it now, because I had a negative experience throughout my childhood. But I was very gifted in the fact that I was co-teaching math and science with some of who I think are the best educators in the state.
That's great.
So they taught me how to teach math and science. I fell in love with it, and that's how I ended up being a STEM teacher.
That's great. So you were in Korea for how long?
2 years.
So 2 years, kindergarten. Teaching English to kindergartners or teaching STEM amongst, what were you teaching, just English or were you teaching like English as a second
language?
I was
primarily teaching reading.
Okay.
So we do reading curriculums and phonics curriculums, but we also taught all the specials classes. So science was a specials class over there.
Okay.
We taught art, we taught music, we taught E. We really just taught everything.
Nice. And that was your first teaching experience?
It was my very first teaching experience. I had gone to school for media studies. I wanted to do like video editing and do like movie trailers or maybe like movie editing or something in that field, in that realm. Yeah. But when I graduated in 08, there weren't jobs anywhere.
Hmm.
And so where they were hiring was schools. And I had been teaching. I hated school growing up, and I never thought I would be an educator whatsoever.
So did I.
Such a bad experience with school. But I had coached cheerleading for 9 years and I loved working with kids. And so when I was looking for a career and something to really become a job and no one was hiring, I thought, I like working with kids. Why don't I try this teaching thing? But I didn't want to go back to school and pay to become a teacher if I didn't know that I liked it. And so I researched ways to become a teacher without a college degree. And I found that you could take like a 100-hour certification class online. Got my TESOL certification. I taught overseas. I eventually came back and got my proper certifications to teach stateside, but really Korea was just my trial run of like, do I want to do this? I never liked school. Do I really want to be a teacher?
And how was
it? How that happened?
I mean, I guess it was great because you stayed with it.
Yes, I love teaching. I think because I had such a negative experience, I had so many negative experiences in school, but I think because I had such a negative experience, Korea was great for two reasons. One, I learned that I have the power to reach kids that don't relate to school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a way to connect with kids that not everyone can. A lot of teachers are like, I was great at school and I was a great student and I always wanted to be a teacher, and they don't understand what it's like to struggle in school.
Hmm.
And then the other thing that it was nice about Korea is education is so highly valued in Asian countries differently than the States. And so they very much believe in growth mindset, which is starting to kick off here, but it wasn't back in our day.
Yeah.
And so I say our day, I'm assuming we're similar ages.
I'll surprise you, but it's okay. Thank you. If you graduated in 08, I am complimented amongst compliments. That is great. So yeah, this mindset, talk about the growth mindset. I love this.
So what I didn't realize when I was teaching in Korea until I started interacting with parents is they very much believe like every child is capable of 100%.
That's
like
amazing.
If they go home and a kid didn't get a perfect on a test, they're like, but they could have.
Mm.
So like if they work hard enough, if they study hard enough, they work hard enough, every kid can succeed. And that was weird to me because I had never succeeded, but I'd also never worked that hard. And so I learned to appreciate that everyone can do well at school. They just have to try, but mm-hmm. they also have to have a teacher that's willing to help them try and believe in themselves.
I'm going to hold you there for a minute. Don't you think that translates into just life in general? Like everybody, so I'll replace a couple of words. Everybody can do well in life, but they just need to have mentors and coaches that can help them understand their unique potential and what they're capable of.
And people have to be able to believe in themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I ended up, my research is so heavily focused on STEM identity. So STEM identity is one's feeling a belonging to STEM, like feeling like there's a place for them in STEM, but also feeling capable of doing STEM. And so my research is so heavily focused on building kids up to just feel capable of doing it, because I don't need to teach them a lot. If they believe that they can do it, they're going to teach themselves.
They'll seek it out. They'll find that. Yeah. So, okay. I love the STEM identity. I think that's such a cool, I had not heard that term before. I think that's really cool that you have a belonging in STEM. And I think a lot of kids don't believe that they fall into those STEM fields, but yet they don't realize that truly there's a world in there that I just don't think they appreciate that they do, and they don't get it. So it's, I want to come back to that, but I want to go back to your laboratory school. This really was wild. So let me see if I understand it correctly. So it's associated with the university.
Mm-hmm.
And you're teaching pre-K through four. And
yeah, so
I'll call it experience. It's, I'm sorry.
Our school is pre-K 8, but I teach pre-K 4.
Pre-K 8. So this school is kind of a unique way of looking at learning. I'm going to assume it does a lot of like play-based learning. And I think you're trying experimental kind of what can we do that is non-traditional? Like we wouldn't think of this as traditional school. And I think you're learning along with the kids in terms of trying things, gauging, maybe retooling. Am I getting this? Like you're kind of on a parallel pathway with these kids.
So every laboratory school is slightly different. Some laboratory schools focus on teacher education. So their primary purpose is for teacher educators that are trained to be teachers to come in and learn how to teach from you.
Mm-hmm.
Some laboratory schools are really focused on research and like what kind of research studies need to be done in education to further the field of education. We are one of the very rare, from what I gather, like one of maybe a small handful of schools that does both. So we focus on research, but we also focus on teacher education. And so every teacher in our school focuses on different aspects of education. I wouldn't say that every teacher does play-based education, but every teacher is focused on some kind of innovative practice that they can do, because we're trying to figure education out. You know, the field of education is in its infancy in terms of research. When you look at like other fields like biology and like more traditional sciences, the science of education is in its infancy. There's so much we don't know about how kids learn and how we should teach kids. This is just a massive experiment to throw kids into classrooms and see if they learn.
It's just over 100 years old in terms of this, what we see in the States here, right? It's the early 1900s.
Yeah.
Kind of born of the Industrial Revolution to create workers is kind of how I see it.
Yeah.
That's like, can you kind of toe the line and follow instructions? I mean, I understand that we're data dumping as well, but at the same time, it's kind of tight and constrained, at least in the traditional sense. I love what you're doing here. So give me an example of like what you would do with your children. I mean, if you want to go on and continue explaining, but then give us an example.
So my research, so I'm doing a research study on this, and then I'm also building curriculum on this, and I'm training other teachers on how to do it. I am very focused in my, it's called makerspace, but in my classroom on play-based learning. And so how do kids naturally learn through play? There's a lot of research on play. The idea that when students are open-ended playing, when they're playing without structure, they naturally learn how to collaborate, how to communicate, how to think critically, how to problem solve, how to have grit and perseverance, how to iterate. All of these things are skills that we're trying to teach in STEM, but it's wild because we're trying to teach it while research shows that kids naturally learn it when they play. And so it depends on every grade. The older they get, the percentages change. But with our youngest kids, so with preschool, it's about 90% play, 10% structure. With kindergarten, it's probably like 80-20. And as they get older, it starts to balance itself out. But essentially, kids come into my classroom. I put out various tools. They're strategically placed out. So like if I really were trying to teach, let's say first grade recently was trying to teach electricity. All of the toys and tools that I'm putting out there have to do with electricity. Mm-hmm. I'm not teaching kids how electricity works. I'm not teaching them how to put a circuit together. But they are experimenting enough with the tools that they're learning it themselves. And then what I'll do is I'll pull small groups aside and I'll start being like, show me what you made. Show me what you're learning. And as they start showing what they learn, I'll either correct misconceptions or I might ask more probing questions to deepen their learning. And I'll start attaching vocabulary to what they're doing. So when someone does something, they're like, oh, I noticed this light bulb has to go this way, but if you turn it the other way, it doesn't work. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's called polarity. And you don't need to know that big word, but the words you could know is positive and negative. And let's look, because this actually tell you which one is positive and negative. I see a plus sign. That means addition. It also means positive. So we start doing things like that. But the reality is that the conceptual knowledge is coming from their play.
From their experience. Yeah, right, right. I love this. So we're born, you know, isn't it wild? Because to hear you talk, and I've heard this before, but I mean, it's almost as if we teach curiosity out of people.
It is exactly what we do.
Like, there's that old study. I don't know if it's old. There's that study where they take like Harvard MBAs or like lawyers and adults, right? And then they take a group of kids and they give them spaghetti and a marshmallow and they have to build a structure to hold the marshmallow. And literally, I think it's time and time and time again, no matter how many people they try it with, the adults spend all the time deciding about like, well, who's going to lead the project and what's going to do this and if we do this and this. And the kids just start going. And they naturally, somebody evolves as like into like, quote unquote, the leader. And then the others, but they try and they fail and they do it again and the adults waste so much time trying to engineer it up front where the kids just get in and do it. And there's wins every time or most times. I won't say every time, but by and large, those kids are more, quote, successful than the adults because they just get in and we have this innate ability to do that. We're innately curious and we try things. And you're right. The grit and the iteration and the perseverance, that's born in watching kids play. It's just how we are.
Yeah. And it's,
it's cool.
To me, it's fascinating because we have systematically taken play out of schools. And then we've also seen a rise in like kids aren't as creative as they used to be. Kids are having a lot more social emotional issues. They can't collaborate like they used to. There's all these struggles coming into play. And the other thing that is wild to me is we talk about how a lot of kids don't feel like they're capable of doing STEM. And it's like, but no one's doing research on the kids in preschool and like kindergarten when they're talking about like girls don't like STEM or we're talking about students with disabilities don't like STEM. they're studying middle schoolers. And I'm like, you're starting off with kids that have already been taught not to like this. Because we taught that.
Yeah.
But no one is spending enough time, not no one, there's like a handful of people doing it, but very few people are looking at our incoming preschooler kindergartners and realizing every kid comes in capable of doing STEM and loving STEM.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the way, we taught them not to. And you can say we didn't teach it, but we had to have, because they came to us feeling confident in their ability. And then by the time they get to middle school, they hate it. So we did that somewhere along the way. And the cool thing about play-based learning and like the experiment you're talking about, that's rapid iteration. Mm-hmm. So when kids are playing, they constantly are rapidly iterating. And it happened today. I had a group of second graders. They built like a tower out of Kiva planks taller than me, and it fell. And of course, there were some tears and there was some frustration, but it was a project. We didn't tell them to make it. They mm-hmm. made it on their own. They were passionate about it. They wanted to build it. So the moment it fell, they cried a few tears, wiped their own tears, and kept going themselves because they wanted to build it. They cared about it.
Rapid iteration.
And when you assign projects, not every kid's going to care about that project. And so when they fail, why do they want to push forward? They don't care. It's not something they wanted to build in the first place. And if it failed, they're going to give up. So it is important to do some structured activities and teach that.
Yes, of course.
Still, they have to learn. But when they're little, it shouldn't be the main
thing. No, not at all. I agree with you. This is great. The rapid iteration, I heard it in a podcast that was talking about SpaceX and how they approached rocketry. And that is exactly, I don't know what the other iteration was. It was like measured, right? It was like how NASA functioned. We're going to engineer, we're going to work, we're going to work, we're going to work, we're going to work, we're going to go. So if this is the timeline and both timelines are equal, the SpaceX engineers start working here, start building, designing, testing, flying, blowing things up. NASA waits until they think they've got it right. Mm-hmm. And then they try it once and boom, what happens? Right. And so what SpaceX engineers were doing was what they were calling rapid iteration to do exactly that. Build that structure. It falls. Okay. Why did it fall? Because the base was, let's build it again. We learned from that failure. Right. And so I love this idea of rapid iteration, because that's exactly how kids play, because they don't really know how to over-engineer and overthink it. They just get into it.
Yeah.
I bet watching these kids is great. I bet you it's fun. Well, I was watching some of your Instagram. It's great. I watched the one where they did the, Taylor Swift song, and then they did the paintings with the little robot. That was really cool.
Yes.
By the way, for everybody listening, we're going to link it below. You got to go watch Brittany's like Instagram page and follow you on whatnot. You're on Blue Sky as well. Mm-hmm. And so we'll get all those links for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. I love that you, like, going back to what we talked about SpaceX. When I do a lot of research. I'm obviously a doctoral student. I do a lot of reading. And the way that we're currently teaching STEM in elementary schools is through the engineering design process. And so it's this like very it shouldn't be, but it's often taught very strictly, where like we hand kids a blank piece of paper and we say, you have to have a plan. Come up with a plan before I let you touch any materials. Come up with a plan. Then once you know exactly what you want to build and exactly what materials you need, I will hand you exactly that many materials, and then you can build. And it's funny, because real engineers have been giving feedback on that process and saying, I don't know why you're calling this the engineer design process. Hmm. We don't engineer that way. We do a lot of hands-on experimentation. We tinker. If something's not working, we put our hands on and we start playing with materials, figure out the properties of those materials, how those materials might work. We experiment, we explore. And that's where the idea comes from, the hands-on experimentation. But the way that we're teaching it in schools is like, we're handing you a blank piece of paper and you can't touch any materials until you have the idea. Yeah. But what kindergartner and first grader has the experience and like the background to know what materials they want to use? So when you talk about rapid iteration and like us doing that in our classrooms, the idea to start doing that has been coming from engineers saying, you need to do this.
This is how we actually do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is fun. Now, are you able to like, so, cause I think this is really interesting. I got to tell you, I think this is something that I feel like education is in a changing dynamic right now. And I really think what the kind of work you're doing is so important, because I inherently believe that this is how we're going to create the kids that are going to be better equipped to handle, especially things like AI and thinking like we've got all the information and it's going to be there. It's going to be, how are you thinking critically about what you're seeing? How are you? And that's through that kind of maintaining that level of like curiosity, and also this kind of little bit of a healthy kind of pessimism about, well, is that really the way that should be? So do you have any like long-term outcome? Like, are these kids going to be followed? Like, are your kindergartners going to be tracked?
Actually, the research study that I'm doing, my professors have told me I'm a little ambitious, but I'm doing it anyway.
Good for you.
My current research study, I'm in the middle of a 5-year study at the very, very beginning stage. I am starting with our kindergartners, tracking how their STEM identity grows and changes over time. And we're going to follow them until they're in fourth grade. See how that grows and changes and explores. So that's one research study that I'm doing. I'm also going to have like a million things I want to do.
Good.
So that's the benefit of working at a lab school, because I do have the time built into my schedule for these kind of things.
Yeah.
I also really want to be able to explore the difference between kids that get play-based STEM education and kids that get very structured STEM education. So I'm hoping to find a school that will partner with me.
You guys hear it.
Care, like, how our class is going versus how their class is going and how kids develop differently. Or maybe they'll develop the same. Then I'll realize, like, hey, it doesn't actually.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, really. I think you've got something going on there. That's great. Yeah. So, whew, okay, this is really cool. So STEM identity, I would say, let me ask you, isn't kind of everything STEM? Everything, like, you ever follow STEM. Chris Woods? You know Chris Woods, that STEM guy? He makes everything STEM, right? And so like he and I,
everything is STEM.
Everything is STEM. So STEM identity is kind of it's funny because it's natural. It's just a natural thing. We all have, we might not identify as STEM people, but I think at the end of the day, the bridge, the little marshmallow thing, that was pure STEM, right? I mean, all of it it's STEM all around you. And it's just a matter of how do you interface with your world, right?
Yeah. So, one of my favorite researchers, Mariana Byers, she works on computer science work with early childhood. She's one of the few people that work in early childhood, and she's prolific when she does it. She has so many studies that she has done. But in her book, she regularly talks about the idea, we're not doing this work because we want to raise computer scientists. We're not teaching kids STEM because there's a need to fill the STEM workforce. There is. And if some of our kids grow up and fill that need, awesome. But we are doing this because it is essential knowledge for every single kid. Whether or not a kid, and I tell parents this all the time because they're regularly like, I don't know that my kid needs your class. It's like, they absolutely need my class. We are teaching kids how to solve problems. And no matter what they do with their life, they have to solve problems. I was talking to a coworker the other day, and she's like, well, I'm not really a STEM person. I don't really need to do STEM. And I'm like, you've never had your lights go out at your house? Never had like a plumbing issue at your house? Have you ever baked cookies?
Have you ever, yes. Like, that's like coding, right? I mean, it's just like following like scripted thing. Like, yes. Right, baking or cooking is very trial and error, right? It's how hot does it have to be? Did I overcook it? Did I burn something? Yes. Did I put too much of this in? Or yeah.
So really everything is STEM, and uh-huh. Everything involves problem solving. Everything involves kids needing to be able to think critically and collaboratively. And really anymore, especially with computer science, it doesn't matter what field kids go into, they're going to be doing some form of coding. There's going to be AI involved. There's going to be like some aspect of like automation. And so whether or not you go into computer science, you're going to experience it in your life. You're probably going to experience it in your job. And having a basic understanding of how it all works is really important for every child.
Agreed. So, all right. So our audience here is other teachers, right? And so this is the Legend Makers. And because we're drone legends, right? And we try to inspire kids, and we try to give teachers are those that create what I call the legends of tomorrow, right? I feel like we started off with this, you know, everybody's capable, right? The Korean family mindset of, well, everybody can get 100. They just need to do the work or believe that they can, or a combination of the both, right? I think belief and work kind of go hand in hand if you believe in something. So a couple of things you said. So I think that is why I do what I do. I don't come out of the education background like you. I won't put words in your mouth. You put them in there. I was a terrible student. I was the kind of kid that you didn't want in your class. I wasn't even just checked out. I was disruptive. So it was like, but I think if I had had, but I was curious and I was really creative and loved to draw and paint and perform. And I couldn't get enough of that outlet. Right. I remember, I've never told this to anybody, but I remember in like kindergarten, we were doing like a little song or whatever, a musical. And I had a tambourine and I was so jazzed to be up in front of people playing that tambourine that I like busted through the tambourine and I had to get me a new one. I'll never forget. Cause I played it with such vigor. I was like, I'm going to play the heck out of this tambourine. And so traditional school just was not for me. I just wasn't in, but when you got me in the creative world, I could play and get immersed. I mean, I can remember literally we used to make these little like paper, they looked like diamonds and they had like the mouth that opened up and we used to do like elaborate, me and my friend would spend hours and hours making like, this is the lion, this is the frog, this is the robot, this is the thing. And we would make hundreds of these really cool, got to see them today. And that is like what you're doing. We were creative. We were in there. We were working. How do we figure out how to make the mouths move and do all this? And then what were we going to use for eyes and all of this cool stuff? So again, I'm just, you've struck a nerve with me because I think you're really onto something. And I like your why. So we think about the audience here, it's other teachers and what they're doing, and maybe they're thinking of entering. And I think you've got a very exciting field of maybe others can get into this, right? Like maybe this changes how people think about entering in education, especially early childhood education. And your why is kind of like you figured, wow, I kind of like working with kids. And now I feel like I can make an impact doing something very unique. So I like your why. And I always want to get to the root of like why somebody does what they do. The other thing that you said, and I just interviewed a guy by the name of Dan Laughingwell, and his pod will be on next week. And he said something where they talk like work-based for older students, and where they try to connect, you know, kind of working on cars and, you know, things like this. And the first question they ask these students is like, if you could solve one problem, what would it be and why? Like, what's a problem that you want to solve? As opposed to, you know, leading with like, what do you think a good business opportunity? It's like, what's the problem? Because if you've got something that you believe in, like this goes back to, it's your project, not somebody else's. If you've got this root, this fundamental belief, and that allows you to persevere, right? Yeah. I've got a cause. I've got something. This is a problem that I feel passionate about or that I think is important. And so therefore, yes, I'm going to fall down. Things aren't going to work. But that's how you keep moving. Go ahead.
Well, I love that, because the other thing is it also ensures if you're coming up with a problem that the thing you're working towards hasn't been done yet. Right? Like if you're coming up with what problem do you want to solve? What problem do you want to work on? If it's a problem, it's because it needs a solution. So you're not just picking something that you're passionate about, because sometimes the things you're passionate about are things other people have already done. But I love starting with the problem because it means that you're putting something out into the world that the world needs.
And oh, I just listened to another pod today. They're talking about first principles thinking and how maybe it's already been done, but is there a different way of doing it?
Yeah.
And that's another one, right? There's still maybe a problem, but it's right in front of our eyes. We just don't see that there's a better or different way of doing it. And you're right. If you find something that you see there's a problem, that's all business is just solving problems, right? Businesses solve problems. People solve problems. Yeah, I think that's great. And so that's, you just got me going there as well. And so what do you think, like, how would you, if you're talking to somebody that's thinking about entering into this field, into the education field, because you're right. I've talked to a lot of teachers, not only here on this podcast, you're like episode 16, but over the last 4 or 5 years, since I started Drone Legends, I work with professional development, teaching them. I get on sales calls with them. We get him workshops. And so I've talked to a lot of teachers, and you're right. A lot of teachers had like that inspirational teacher when they were young. They loved being in the classroom. It just kind of felt natural to them. Yeah. They were the good student, right? Right. A lot of them were like that, right? You weren't. So what would you say though to somebody? I mean, and the thing is, I think we need teachers, don't we? We're always going to need teachers. And so for those listening, if they're maybe thinking about it, or they're kind of entering it and maybe a little like concerned, did I make the right decision? Is this the right thing for me to do? What would you say to those folks?
Entering education as a whole, or entering STEM Ed, or just...
All right, let's talk, just let's go broad. And then we can, if you want to narrow it down, let's do that.
I think that there's unfortunately a lot of negativity around teaching right now, and there is a teaching shortage. And, you know, we talk about this a lot actually working at a university, because we're seeing less and less people enroll in like colleges for education. Yeah. So it is a question that comes up a lot. Like, what are we going to do to inspire teachers to teach? I think that the biggest thing for teachers is to, I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but a lot of young teachers that I talk to are like, there's so much pressure on me to do this and this and this and this and this. And the first question I always ask is, by who? Like, by my administration, or by like leaders, or by my parents. And I'm like, but has anybody ever actually told you that you have to do these things? Has anybody actually told you that you can't do play-based learning, or that you can't try this, that you can't do different ideas, or that you have to spend your time doing this? And the reality is that teachers tend to put a lot of pressure on themselves based on like this negative public perception of teachers by all this negativity on social media about teachers. There's a lot of pressure on us to do any and everything. Mm-hmm. And my experience is that nobody's putting more pressure on teachers than us, like we're putting on ourselves. And so I think teachers need to get away from this idea that they have to be everything to everyone all of the time, that they have to be perfect. And just be willing to try it. If you like kids, that's my very first thing. If you don't like kids, don't come into education. A lot of people are like, well, I really like science, and kids are, and I'm like, then go
work with science.
Yes. But if you like working with kids, the kids are what's going to bring you joy. And you get to make your own classroom experience whatever you want it to be. And 9 times out of 10, if you're feeling a pressure that you have to do something, it's probably not pressure from someone else, probably pressure that you're putting on yourself. Mm. Most people, when they ask me, like, how do you get away with playing every day? I say, well, I walk into my administrator's office and I say, here's the research on why we should be teaching through play. And my administrator's like, it's research based. Go do it. Why are you asking me? Mm. And I've never met a professor that didn't feel that way, like when they're talking about their student teachers. Yeah. They're training, and I've never met any, we've gone through a lot of administrators in our school. I've never met one that didn't feel that way, that if you can present evidence that you know something's working, do it. No one's stopping you. You're the one stopping you.
Wow.
I don't know how that answered your question.
It was great. I haven't heard that before. That's great. So you're right. I guess teachers are their worst critics, and they put a lot of pressure on themselves from external factors that may or may not exist. It's kind of like we make these things up in our heads. Is he going to call? Is she going to call? You know, right. This is kind of the age old thing. Like, we can create the maelstrom in here when the reality outside is probably a lot different.
And like, to be fair, social media is very, very loud with a lot of teacher negativity, and teachers hear that. We just went through a rough election. We heard a lot of really negative things about teachers through all of the politics going on. Mm-hmm. So it's not coming from nowhere. But my experience is, if you know, like, teachers know what they're talking about. They've gone to school for this. They've seen it. They know what they're talking about. If you present people with evidence, very few people are actually going to stop you from doing what kids need. It's us that feel like someone's going to slap our hand, or someone's gonna obviously yell at us. It's like, are they?
Try it, right?
Do it.
Do it and then apologize later, right?
That's kind of my motto in all things. I will ask forgiveness before I ask permission.
There you go. Ask forgiveness later. That's what it was. Yeah. So what do you think the bigger challenges are? I mean, I think you're touched on a lot of them, but let's kind of crystallize those into kind of a thought. Like, what do you think today in, let's call it elementary education, but education as a whole, I think there's got a lot of challenges, but what do you think the major ones are?
So I'm going to just talk about STEM education because it's what I know.
That's great. Yep.
And it's really what my mission is. It's why I do everything that I do.
Okay.
Elementary ed teachers are trained intensively to teach reading and somewhat intensively to teach math. And that's what they know. Mm. And there's this really big federal, state, local push to teach STEM, as there should be. Like, I am a STEM educator. The push should be there. So there's a lot of money being thrown at STEM. There's a lot of grants out there. There's a lot of companies willing to donate a lot of things. There's a lot of information out there, and it's really loud. But at the end of the day, our elementary teachers don't know what they're doing. And yeah, it's not all. But we don't teach elementary teachers to be STEM specialists. We teach them to teach reading. And at some point, they may learn to teach math really well, but even that's debatable. And it's not the teacher's fault. They just aren't taught how to teach STEM. And so a growing trend that is happening in a lot of schools, and it's deeply concerning, is more and more schools are like, STEM is the new thing. We're going to start a STEM class.
Yeah.
And we're going to throw thousands of dollars into curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hire a first grade teacher who's taught first grade for 20 years because she obviously knows how to teach children. And she does.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to throw them in the STEM class. And they'll know what to do. They don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So you see all these social media posts left and right. I get DMs all the time of teachers being like, they're giving me $30,000 to buy whatever I would like.
Right.
And I don't know even the first thing to buy. And I'm like, oh my God.
I see it too. Obviously, I see it.
Like, that is so concerning because you don't need any money to teach them. You can teach with cardboard.
Right.
You don't need all the fancy tools. You can teach STEM for free. But if you don't know how to teach STEM and they're not putting that money into educating teachers to teach STEM, that's concerning.
So
that's, to me, like the biggest concern that I have about education right now is that there's a lot of government organizations, school boards, businesses throwing money
into
STEM, and nobody's putting research into elementary STEM. And to know like really what best practices are, and nobody's putting money and time into training qualified teachers. My state and a lot of states don't even certify teachers for STEM.
Right. And you're in Illinois, right?
And I'm in Illinois. And yeah, right. I have a degree in STEM, but anyone in Illinois doing my job does not have to be certified to teach STEM. They just have to have a teaching license.
What do you do if you are a teacher that's, because I've heard this, you're not the first, and I see it, and that's our programs, not to be, you know, self-promotion here for a minute, but we try to make it turnkey enough to where, because we feel that pain, right, of, wow, I've been asked to bring, and what's cool and new? Well, how am I going to do that, right? What does that look like, right? Robots or drones or whatever it might be, right? How in the world am I going to do that? So what do you suggest? So there's the problem. What's the possible solution? Is it STEM certification? Does your research, I mean, do you coach, mentor? How does this work?
So I coach and I mentor as much as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. I'm getting research out there as much as I possibly can. I think there are a lot of people that know what they're doing that are trying to mentor and coach teachers, and they're doing an amazing job. There are also a lot of people out there who have seen that STEM is a hot topic and they can make money off of it.
Yeah.
And they are promoting themselves as STEM mentors and STEM curriculums that people can buy, but they're not run by people that truly know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, I taught STEM for 2 years. And it's like, okay, but what did you teach before that? What's your degree in? What qualifies you to do this? Well, this is what I did to get by.
Mm.
It's like, hey, I appreciate you sharing your resources. That's great. But look at how many people you're helping, and is it research-based? So when we talk about solutions, we have to put more money into the research. Those of us who are qualified and trained just need to keep doing what we're doing. You know, a lot of teachers on social media that I connect regularly with do know what they're doing. They are trained. They are certified, doing the great work. You invite a lot of them onto your podcast. They are really great, well-educated people. My hope is that they can just keep getting a widespread reach, that districts are willing to put money into training them, into paying people to train them, and that we stop throwing money at curriculums that we think are going to just solve the problem. The reality is that curriculum is a tool, and there is no curriculum for STEM that you can write that a teacher without training could pick up and teach, because a good STEM curriculum is student-led. And if you can't recognize the path that students are taking and like zig and zag as students go one way or the other and know what questions to ask kids, if you're trying to follow a scripted curriculum, it's never going to work. I mean, I think the solution is people are already doing it. It's a grassroots kind of thing. We just have to keep moving along. And I hope that districts can recognize the companies that are doing actual good work. Right. One of my favorite ed tech companies is KinderLab Robotics. Because it was founded by, the Kibo robot that they promote was created by Mariana Byers. She was trained by MIT's Media Lab. They do a lot of great work on student-led curriculum and constructionist curriculum and how kids actually learn and develop creative thinking. Companies like that, I hope districts start funneling their resources into that instead of just well-known, what's popular, well-known. I hope that they're like, what research did this company do to lead them to this product that they made?
Got it. That's cool. Yeah, that's great. That is great. No, you got a book in you. No, I love that. That's what this is for. You have a book in you, right? Or you've got your research, and your research will be published.
I think at some point I probably will end up writing a book, but I have a lot of articles I have to write for my program. So
yeah, you compile those. Well, that's the basis for your book, right? I mean, those would be when you want to write, because I think you've got an amazing. You are the person that people should be listening to when it comes to this stuff. So I'm going to stay talking to you for sure, because we always want to get better here. All right, let's do this. I'm looking at time. I want to ask you this. So this is where I leave off with this every time. So optimism, right? The future. Where are we going? What makes you excited? What do you, of all the, you know, we just talked about some of the challenges and some of the things. Where do you see the opportunity? What excites you in education, STEM, let's stay with STEM, moving forward?
So I think regardless of the fact there's a lot of negativity around education, there is also a lot of teachers pushing back against this like prescriptive, like Pearson-led state politics running our classrooms that have no education background. There's a lot of teachers fighting back about the changes that we've made in education recently. So I get empowered daily when I log into social media or wherever my PLNs are, and I hear teachers being like, standardized testing, not great. You know what I decided to do in my classroom instead? Play. And you want to know the growth that we've seen in our kids just from letting them play? Amazing. I love seeing teachers really resisting this idea of what we're supposed to do. Instead, embracing what they know in their hearts to be true about kids and education, and kind of just being the change makers in their own classroom. I think that there's a lot of people who are realizing that the education structure that we've had in place for a while now doesn't work anymore. I don't love the idea of all of these private schools kind of popping up to like teach alternative education. But I do think it's forcing public schools to start re-examining what they're doing. I see a lot of public schools piloting a lot of cool ideas, starting a lot of cool classes, things like in my room when they're like, yeah, you know what? She's got some crazy ideas about like kids just playing and that sounds weird, but let's just trust her for a year or two and see if it works. And right. As it does work, like UNA administration gets behind you, parents get behind you, other teachers get behind you. So that gives me a lot of positive energy. Yeah. But truly, like, what makes me the most optimistic every single day is seeing the way that I'm teaching work. Yeah. So I will use the Taylor Swift example from that Instagram video that you watched.
Yeah, it was great.
So for anyone listening, essentially what it is was me showcasing three kindergartners who were playing with a Kibo robot. And I couldn't understand what they were building for the longest time. They just kept saying that they were going to make a summer dance. And I was like, that's fun. Like summer and winter, let's go. They were trying to make the cruel summer, like Taylor Swift. They were trying to turn the Kibo into Taylor Swift. and get
awesome.
A robot to do the cruel summer dance. So this is what excites me about education, is walking into my classroom and saying, hey, I assigned this creative robotics project in kindergarten. It is a project that every year makes me question what I'm doing, because I assigned the project and I'm very excited about it. I'm like, robotics can be used for creative endeavors. They can make robotics, make music, robots solve problems, but robots also make art and they tell stories. And like, we talk about like Disney animatronics at Disney mm-hmm. World. We will showcase like the fireworks show at Disney. To be like that, all of those fireworks are coded by an engineer.
Yeah.
We will show like paintings that are made by computers. We will show songs that are made on computers, but we start the project. I'm always very excited about it because kids get excited. And then they all have these wonderful ideas. But the problem with kindergarten is they're not articulate yet. Mm-hmm. They're learning how to communicate. And so they'll be telling me their ideas. And I'm always like, okay, you're not explaining this very well, but do you understand what you're building? Yes. Go for it.
Yeah.
And about like 3 or 4 days in, it's chaos. Like, I'm looking around the room and I'm like, I thought you were building a pretty picture and you just tore the entire picture up into pieces. Do you still have a plan? Yes, I do, Miss Star. Are you sure? And I always start to second guess them. And I always start to say, like, should I be giving kids such open choice? They've lost the plot. Mm. No one knows what they're doing. And on the very last day, I'm always rewarded. Because I'll sit down. And like, I'll give you two examples. The first example, I sat down and this kid had drawn this really beautiful Star Wars story. And then on the very last day had cut the whole thing up into pieces. And I was like, why would you do that? It looked so good before. And he said, it's part of my project. Okay.
Okay.
And I wanted to record it for his family. I was like, tell me about what you made. And he was like, so in a galaxy far, far away, a long, long time ago, they were escaping a world that was like falling apart and they had to get off of this planet before it got destroyed. I was like, okay, tell me about this thing that I see you cut your drawing up. And they were like, that was the earthquakes destroying the world. They had to escape. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was the earthquakes.
That's it.
Destroying the world. I thought you were destroying your project.
Yeah.
What you were doing. I didn't know what you were doing. I asked you what you were doing.
Right.
So they get to the end of these projects and you're like, these kids know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Vision. They execute their vision. And sometimes they finish their project. Sometimes they don't. But it's not for us to decide what their like creative endeavor should look like or should be. So it's always a really cool, rewarding.
So experience. He first created the world and then then it crumbled apart. And that's how he visualized like, it was. Was that this world's falling apart, so I have to cut it all up to show the pieces of the world that once was, the pieces of what used to be a whole, right?
Yeah.
But to your mind, you're just like, chopping up a piece, a painting, a picture.
Have you shown your parents what you did?
That's great. Oh, yeah. I love it. And so you said you had two. What's the other one?
Yeah, so the Taylor Swift one, which I did post on Instagram.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If you watch their, like, they spent so long just, like, what looked like scribbling paint. I do this project with our art teacher. So in both of our classes, they were just like scribbling on the thing. And I was always like, what are you drawing? And they're like, a drawing of summer. I'm like, I don't know how any of this looks like summer. They just look like scribbles.
Right.
Like, okay, go for it. Because if you're ever in my classroom, that's usually my thing is like, if a kid sounds confident about something and I don't understand what they're doing, I'm usually just like, whatever. Just what's the worst that could happen? Just go for it.
Go for it.
You care about it, so I'm going to let you do your thing. The worst thing that could happen is it fails, and then we talk about it afterwards. No big deal.
Right. So
they're scribbling on the whole thing, and it's finally time to record, and they haven't decorated their robot like they thought they were going to. It's looking like it's a disaster. Okay, tell me about what you made. And they were like, we made the dance of summer. I was like, okay. And they were like, those were like the different movements that you make when you're dancing. It's what dancing looks like. I was like, oh my gosh, they weren't just scribbling. That was them like showing like visually what a dance would look like. I was like, okay, that sounds really actually pretty deep. So I'm just going to learn from you. And then afterwards, I don't know what clicked in it, but when they held up their papers and they're like, what if we had had more time, we would have put on our robot. I was like, well, what are they? And they're like, they're summer colors. And so, I don't know what made me think to ask this, but I was like, what song are you doing? And they said, Cool Summer. And I was like, oh my gosh.
It all came together.
Taylor Swift robot. Is that supposed to look like Taylor Swift? And they're like, yeah, we're making her outfit. And I was like.
And then the tracks were where they were going to dance, right? Yes. The dance of the summer. So they basically painted movement.
Yes.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I would love, that sounds like such a fun environment. Like,
yeah.
I love kids. I love kids too. I love, cause I'm a big one. I'm hyper curious. I love to learn. I still love to learn new things. I learn new things every single day, listening to podcasts and reading. And I love the curiosity of little kids. I love these stories. These stories, I could listen to hundreds of these stories because they know what they're doing. Yes. In their mind, they've got it figured out. Like, not figured out, but they know they understand why they're doing something. There's a reason why they're doing it. It's not just random. It's not random at all. There's a method behind what we see as this madness, when in fact, it's not madness at all. It's absolutely steeped in like, yeah, I got this. I know what I'm doing. And I may not have all the exact, it might not exactly show up the way I thought it might, but we're just going to go for it and watch what we create.
And that's, to me, like such a defining thing about early childhood STEM.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember they are little and they have really powerful ideas. These kids are so innately smart and creative and driven, but they also don't have a lot of linguistic skills yet.
Right.
Especially when we start talking about our kids with disabilities and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't always expect that they can verbally communicate what they're doing. And I think a lot of times we don't give kids enough credit. It's because they can't explain themselves. And we're like, mm-hmm. Oh, you don't know, sweetie. So that's too hard for you, or you can't, maybe we're not going to do that plan. But I've just long ago, I think it's, maybe it's because I started out working with kids that didn't speak English.
Yeah, maybe.
English, that I just got used to, like, we're not communicating here, but like, it's fine. Like, we found other ways to communicate. But the kids are so capable.
Yeah.
If you give them the opportunity, they will always succeed your expectations. I will never forget. I do woodworking.
Okay.
Childhood. I don't think it's weird. People think it's weird.
What, that you do woodworking?
Woodworking with kids. Oh, like, I do preschoolers, hammers, and nails. I don't know. It seems appropriate.
You do? You give them actual hammers and nails?
Yes.
This is great. All right. So go on.
So I always tell parents that I'm going to do it. And I'm like, hey, it's preschool. We're starting a woodworking unit. They're going to be using hammers and nails, making projects. We do have some safety rules. And if kids can't regulate themselves in the day that it's their turn, they won't be allowed to have a turn because it is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And some of our kids just developmentally are not always able to handle dangerous things. And so I always preface that. I've never had to actually deny a kid the experience of doing it, but just like a safety thing, like if a kid ever came in completely off the rails, dysregulated, we would just hold off on this assignment and we would teach them how to do it next year, like we just later. And every time the parents are like, that sounds great. Sounds great. Sure. And last year, one of my families, after they sent the project home, sent me a message and they were like, they use real nails.
What are we talking? Like nails, like real hammers and nails, like heavy hammers and things.
Yeah. But the parent was like, real nails. And I was like, yeah, I told you I was going to. And they were like, yeah, but I just assumed you meant like plastic nails and like a hammer. I didn't think they were actually going to do woodworking. And I was like, yeah, he did great. It was a great project. But that parent said, I never thought my kid could do that.
Right.
And even when you told me they were doing it, I still didn't believe it until they brought their project home. And I asked them, like, did Miss Tarr do that for you? And they were like, no, I did this. And cool. That family, like, went to Home Depot that weekend and bought a whole bunch of, like, tools and stuff to do at home with their child. And they said, we never would have done this.
Right.
If you hadn't shown us it was possible first. And that's not like an outlier story. I have many more stories of parents saying things like that. Mm-hmm. But it really is like kids are just so, so capable. And we deny them so many opportunities to do so just because we don't think they can. And it's always fun to show other adults like, no, my kid did that. No, our preschoolers did that. Our admin always walks in. They're like, what are you doing now? Like, oh, my preschooler is building circuits. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, watch them.
They're building circuits.
They're building circuits. And they do.
I love it. Could we do this with older? I mean, I think the answer is going to be yes, but like, it feels like this should be, I'd love to see a group of like middle graders or even early high schoolers being given these kind of like these woodwork, these like this summer dance. Like, I love these open-ended kind of just go do, you know, go wander, explore, and come up with something together without a lot of no real direction, just kind of a looming kind of objective, right? Just this kind of like, it's got to kind of, this is the rough framework, but beyond that, like you guys go and nobody's going to watch you. Nobody's going to monitor you. Just kind of do it and let's see where you end up. I'd love to see this replicated like with older students. I'm sure people do it.
Last year I taught fifth and sixth grade. We were doing a study. So our older makerspace teacher was teaching a class, a makerspace type class the entire day from 8 to 3. And so I took over her fifth and sixth grade class. And it was the first time, I guess, many people had taught fifth and sixth graders in a play-based approach. But I did. I said, hey, we do have to learn. The only thing I've been told about your grade, this was fifth and sixth grade, was that you have to learn the sustainability goals from the UN.
Okay.
That's the only thing anybody told me that you had to learn. And so they gave me a lot of like very directed projects that we could do, but I don't want to do that, and neither do you. So I just said, why don't we spend a week just researching the sustainable development goals? And then you come to me and tell me, what do you want to make that's going to solve a problem? And every kid came back with a different goal. One kid wanted to learn how to use a 3D printer to make like a filtered straw to do clean water for poor countries. Like you could just like keep in a backpack and just always have filtered water. Mm-hmm. That was really cool. Yep. One group of girls wanted to learn how to do a podcast. Because they wanted to make a podcast on gender equality and like interview people at the school and solve problems of gender inequality in their own school. So that was really cool. They interviewed different teachers and made like a whole series of podcast episodes.
Right.
One group of kids was really passionate about climate change. Mm-hmm. But they were like, I don't know how to solve climate change, but here's a company that's already doing really important work. Could we do something to raise money for this company? And I was like, what a great, you realize somebody's doing the work. You just want to support them. So what do you want to do? One of them planned a bake sale and raised like $500.
Wow.
And then another one were like, well, we kind of want to learn how to crochet, which has nothing to do with these goals, but we do want to raise money for this company doing this work. Can we learn to crochet, sell that stuff, and then donate that money? I was like, sure.
Wow.
One group learned how to solder. So they could like solar power stuff. So you can do this with any grade, but I think you as a teacher have to be willing to just let go of a lot of the control and not know what the end goal is going to be. Some of our projects failed.
Sure.
Spectacularly failed.
I'm sure they do. But they learn from that. It's fine. Yeah. It's not the end of the world, right? It's fine. That's great. Oh, listen, I could talk to you forever. This is really interesting stuff. You're very interesting. I love what you're doing. I'm sure this is going to be a popular episode because you're just doing something a little different and I love it. And I think it's really the trend. I think if I heard you at the end there, what makes you optimistic is that we are in, you know, out of chaos is born opportunity. And I think education as a whole, as we've known it, is due for a major disruption. I think COVID had a lot to do with it, exposed a lot of problems in our system. And so, moving forward, hopefully this becomes more of a trend. And it because I think it's just going to be that way that students have to learn. I love it. So I could do this forever. What I'm going to ask you to do is because you dropped some really great pearls. And what I like to do is put links, like you referenced a study or you mentioned one of your mentors there and a book. And so what I'd like you to do, if you would, please just follow up with an email so I can put all these hyperlinks into some of these great resources, because you are filled with great information and great energy too, by the way. I think I can see your passion. You're very passionate about what you do. So Brittany, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was great to meet you.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
You got it. Thanks so much.